I will have a dedicated page for that book on that website. It'll give you all the information about that. And also you can check out my current book, which is It's Not Over, Learning from the Socialist Experiment. There's also a page for that on my systemic disorder website as well.
Thank you so much, Professor. We've learned a lot today. I really appreciate it. Pete Dolek, thanks so much for being with us and keeping democracy alive. And maybe we can have more democracy. What a concept. Thank you.
It would be a wonderful idea. Thank you for having me.
Money. Money makes the world go around. The world go around. The world go around. Money makes the world go around. It makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound. A mark, a yen, a buck, or a pound. Is all that makes the world go around. That clinking, clanging sound. Money, 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 money. If you happen to be rich and you feel like a knight, entertainment you can pay for the escapade. If you happen to be rich and alone and you need a companion, you can ring ting-a-ling for the mate. If you happen to be rich and you find you are left by your lover and you moan and you groan quite a lot, you can take it on the chin, call a cab and begin to recover on your 14-carat yacht. What? Money makes the world go round, the world go round, the world go round. Money makes the world go round.
If you enjoyed that discussion, don't miss a single show. Subscribe. It's all free. It's on Apple, Spotify, Progressive Radio Network, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and of course, the website, keepingdemocracyalive.com. Thanks very much.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
During the last 6 weeks, you heard the special programming of our winter fundraising drive. Thank you for supporting Volume 2 of the All Thrills, No Frills campaign. KBOO is on course to exceed our goal of $17,000 as the final checks come through the mail. If you haven't already, get your limited edition Bluegrass Marathon t-shirt. Please go to kboo.fm/bgshirt. This design was created by a volunteer creator from Music from the True Vine, which airs every Saturday at 9 a.m. Don't wait. Get yours now. Go to kboo.fm/bgshirt. Again, thank you for supporting your community radio, KBOO FM.
Hello, dear listeners. Oil for Kisses is a monthly program on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, that highlights the headier and weirder sides of underground metal, post-punk, DIY hardcore, and beyond. Every month features a different theme where we delve into the history of a specific genre topic or musical location, or simply churn out the best, brightest, and ugliest sounds from around the globe. Join me, DJ Krauthammer, every first Friday night, Saturday morning of the month, at midnight till 3 a.m. for Oil for Kisses to experience it for yourself. Only on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
From the studio of KPFA in Berkeley, California, it's Flashpoint on Pacifica Radio. On today's program, senior producer Kevin Pina brings us an interview with Dan Kovalik. And later in the program, Kevin brings us a retrospective on People's Park in Berkeley. All this coming up straight ahead on the program. Stay tuned.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, today we're going to discuss Ukraine and what's going on there from a kind of different perspective with my guest today, Daniel Kovalik, who's an American lawyer and human rights advocate who currently teaches international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. He graduated from Columbia University School of Law in 1993. He then served as an in-house counsel for the United Steelworkers AFL-CIO, the USW, until 2019. Dan is also the author of several books, including his most recent, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela, How the U.S. is Orchestrating a Coup for Oil, which includes a foreword by a good friend of this show, Oliver Stone. He also wrote what I believe is the prescient book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, which was published in 2017. Dan Kovalik, welcome back to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. It's been too long.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Kevin.
Well, you know, I want to just say, you know, some of the headlines today are interesting. I don't know if you read that The IMF just approved a $15.6 billion loan to Ukraine. At the same time, I believe today, Russia takes the seat as the head of the United Nations Security Council. You've also got, it's just amazing. You know, you've got at this point, Ukraine is $46.6 billion expenditure on the U.S. books, U.S. taxpayer books, which apparently is now exceeding the cost of the war in Afghanistan, which, of course, is the longest occupation in U.S. history. And that was $43.4 billion. So this thing keeps cooking. And of course, I've had my fill, as I'm sure a lot of people have, of the feel good about the Ukraine war stories on NPR, National Public Radio. And I wanted to do something different to sort of look at it through the perspective of a greater critique of the narrative that we're having in this country versus what you see as the reality there. But let me start with your book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, which you published in 2017. Do you see that as in any way as having set the context for what we're seeing unfold in Ukraine today?
Yes, I do. In fact, I wrote the book in 2017 because I feared that we were heading towards a war with Russia, that we were heading towards a conflict of the type we are in right now, where we are now really at war with Russia through the proxy of Ukraine. And a few of us saw that coming even back then, because, well, for a few reasons. By then, the government in Ukraine, which the U.S. helped put in power through an illegal coup in 2014, by the way, was already at war with its own people, its own ethnic Russians and Russian speakers in the Donbass for 3 years by 2017. And I was quite aware of that. I was writing about that even then. And it was very clear to me that at some point Russia would have to respond to this, you know. And it was also very clear to me that this was intentional, that the U.S. wanted to provoke Russia. On top of that, of course, you had Russiagate, you know, which was a hoax. I think it's largely, if not entirely, been debunked. This claim that somehow Russia interfered in the 2016 elections on behalf of Trump. And that actually became the main propaganda point to really incite support for a conflict with Russia. And actually, it still is. I mean, even though it's been debunked, most of the people who believed in Russiagate to begin with either still believe it, or even if they don't believe it, the stink of that hoax, you know, lingers. You know, that is to say, they still hate Russia. They may forget even why, but they knew back then that there was some reason to hate Russia and Putin, so we're going to just keep hating them. So it worked. That propaganda effort worked very well. And again, I wrote the book in 2017 to try to undermine the Russiagate claims, to try to say that Russia's not our enemy, all in an effort, along with some other people. Stephen F. Cohen was saying similar things at that time. So was Oliver Stone, who you mentioned, who wrote, you know, he had his Putin interviews at that time. We were all saying, look, you know, we're going down a very bad road here. And we have now found ourselves at the end of that road, not quite at the end, but way down that road in this present conflict. And if we're not careful, we're going to be in a direct confrontation with Russia. So, yes, to put it bluntly, I do think that book I wrote is still very applicable.
Well, I called it prescient because I agree with you. And let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and my guest today is Dan Kovalik. He's an American lawyer and human rights advocate who currently teaches international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. He's also an international human rights activist. He's been to several places throughout the world investigating U.S. claims of human rights abuses and refuting them, or at least bringing some edge of sanity, I would say, to a lot of that. But, you know, I want also to also let our listeners know, you should look up somebody. If you think that this is just something from the left, you should look up John Mersheimer. John Mersheimer is not a leftist. John Mersheimer is a conservative political analyst, political scholar, who very much also has said that the U.S. provoked the war with Ukraine, that it was an intentional provocation. I want to get a little bit into NATO, right, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. And I was reading through the treaty the other day, Dan, and the United States government has mentioned, I think, 5 or 6 key moments in that treaty. And what becomes clear is that the United States government is, and for me, this is another point of American exceptionalism, it is the official repository of all the documents. It's the officiator of what is legitimate, who gets to join. All of the documents have to be filed in Washington. It's at the center of what NATO is and NATO's founding in 1949. I'm just wondering, how do you see the role of NATO today? Because there's also this presentation in the press of the evil Putin versus this alliance of good guys, which almost has a World War II motif feeling to it.
Yeah, well, or maybe more accurately, I think it has the motif of the first Cold War, of the West versus the Soviet Union, which is why NATO was set up, to counter the Soviet Union and the East Bloc, of course. NATO today, first of all, is not a defensive organization. It is an offensive organization, right? So NATO was involved in the 78-day bombing of Serbia in 1999, which mostly targeted civilians and civilian infrastructure, which many people either don't know or forgot about. And by the way, there were two moments in which that war could have been prevented through peace deals. And in both cases, the U.S. intervened to prevent peace from breaking out, as they have now in the Ukraine conflict. We know that the U.S. has prevented a peace deal, which was, you know, possible back in March of last year. But even before that, with the Minsk agreements, which were supposed to end the conflict between the government in Ukraine and its own people in the Donbass. And of course, the U.S. did everything it could to make sure the Minsk agreements were not abided by. But
Before you go on, explain to our listeners a little bit more about the Minsk agreement and what it is and why you feel that way about it.
Yeah, well, first of all, so there were two Minsk agreements, and they were agreed to and unanimously approved by the UN Security Council to end the war in Ukraine that started in 2014. And it was a war in which the government of Ukraine and its armed forces and its right-wing allies, some neo-Nazi allies, attacked their own people in the Donbass, which I visited, by the way, last November. And in that conflict, 14,000 people died before February of last year.
14,000?
Yes. And that is a figure from the UN High Commission on Human Rights. This is not a controversial point, though, again, the Western press would like you to forget that that happened and that those 14,000 people died. They'd like you to forget those people in the Donbass even exist, is the truth of it. You never even hear about them. And so the Minsk agreements were agreed to in order to stop that war, to end it. And there are a number of requirements of it. One, of course, was that the government in Kiev would stop shelling its own people in the Donbass, which never happened. They never stopped doing that. And what we found out later, you know, one of the guarantors of the Minsk agreements, meaning one of the countries that agreed to make sure it would be abided by, was Germany, at that time headed by Angela Merkel, the chancellor. Well, she recently said that they never intended to abide by the Minsk agreements, that the Minsk agreements were agreed to simply to allow Ukraine to arm to the point where it could fight Russia. She said that, and then right after she said it, former French President Hollande also said that. He said, yeah, that's right. Zelensky then said, yeah, that's correct. With no one on our side, the West side, took those agreements seriously and never really intended for them to be abided by. So, and again, the U.S. never intended for that to happen either, and never, certainly never prevailed on Ukraine to abide by that agreement. So, but going back to NATO a little bit, so not only did NATO attack Serbia, of course, it also attacked Libya, also based on lies. From March of 2011, October 2011, and left Libya in a shambles. So Libya went from being the most prosperous country in Africa to the least prosperous. It is now run by three separate warring factions, and slaves are now being sold on in open markets there. It was a complete disaster. But this was a NATO production, of course. And now NATO, of course, is behind Ukraine in this conflict with Russia. So what is NATO? I mean, or the essence of it, which is your question. What is the essence of it today? I mean, frankly, it's an interest. It is an instrument of U.S. foreign policy.
So it's a projection of U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah, it's not working for Europe, right? I mean, because the sanctions that have been imposed on Russia and this war with Russia has fatally undermined some of the economies in Europe, particularly Germany's. And also, we now know from Seymour Hersh, and I believe what he's saying, that the U.S. was behind the sabotage of the Nord Stream pipelines, which, again, a German Chancellor Angela Merkel desperately wanted and begged Putin for, because Western Europe is dependent on natural gas from Russia, even during the time of the Cold War, even when it was the Soviet Union.
Well, and now, of course, we're seeing in the U.S. press finally an acknowledgement that the sanctions against Russia aren't working, and that, in fact, Europe is suffering as a result of the higher price of gas that they're importing from the United States.
Exactly. And they will into the future, because the Nord Stream is gone, you know, so they can't even turn. Not easily. They'll have to spend billions of dollars.
Now, the Nord Stream was a pipeline, right, that went from Russia to Europe.
Yes.
Okay.
And again, Angela Merkel was the one who begged for this, begged Putin. And Putin said, well, I don't know, in terms of Nord Stream 2. She begged Putin for it, and Putin said, well, I don't know. I don't know if we should expend money on this, because the U.S. is just going to intervene and prevent you from using it. And she said, no, I promise that'll never happen. Of course, bing, it happened. So in any case, NATO, and again, NATO's support for Ukraine is not working out at all for our allies, our NATO allies in Europe. It's only working well for the U.S. defense industry and for U.S. oil and natural gas interests, because now Europe's going to have to buy from them instead of from Russia. And that seems to be a big point of the conflict, that's why the U.S. wanted this conflict. And
let me remind our listeners to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we're talking to Dan Kovalik about Ukraine and his perspective about what's going on there today. Sorry, Dan, didn't mean to interrupt. Just want folks to know.
No, it's okay. And either Western Europe didn't understand that these were the true goals, or you know, was too weak to resist. But that's where we're at now. Of course, where there's major protest in France. One of the demands being for France to get out of NATO. There's big protests in Germany saying the same thing. In Britain, there's smaller protests, but also anti-NATO protests there. People in Europe are waking up to the fact that NATO ain't working for them. And, what? You know, so anyway, but Americans have been misled. They think, oh, this is, you know, all of Europe's on board with this. Well, the governments have been. That is true. But the people are really turning away from it, because it is not working for their interest. Again, it may be working for someone's interest, but not the vast majority of the people. And it's not working for the vast majority of the people in the United States, right? We're sending billions of dollars out the door to Ukraine while our infrastructure is collapsing, while we have trains derailing all over the place, right? While people are homeless. I just saw a statistic today that there's 1.5 million homeless children in America. Can you imagine that? We have no money to help.
13, I think it's 15 million was the last figure I read.
Of people or children?
Of children living in poverty in the United States.
So living in poverty, right. And 1.5 million homeless children.
Right.
So, but meanwhile, so we have money for Ukraine, and apparently as much money as, you know, as Zelensky wants, but no money for those homeless children, no money for decent education or health care. So the vast majority of the Americans are not being helped by this war either, but at least a sizable proportion of the country, I'd say about 50% more, give or take, are behind the war because, again, going back to the question about my book in 2017, because the groundwork, the propaganda groundwork for this war has been laid for some time. And ironically, and you touched on this a little, ironically, it's been liberals who've been most impacted by that propaganda, right? Because the Russiagate was aimed at liberals because the claim was that it was Trump won through colluding with Russia, right?
I don't have any time for either political party, the Republicans or the Democrats. I got my own view about that, but this has primarily been coming from the Democratic Party.
Yeah, this is a Democratic liberal thing. And again, what is tragic is that people who were, the liberals who, at least in the base, not the party, not the Democratic Party, which has always been a warmongering party, but its base is where the peace movement has largely come from. Right. But that has died. The liberal support for peace is out the window. And again, Russiagate largely did that. It's been very effective that way.
At dividing that movement, which once at least could agree that it was anti-war. And of course, that coming from the history of the Vietnam War, we could trace that peace movement, right? And now suddenly it finds itself divided over issues of how the Democratic Party is positing what is in the best interest of the United States.
Yeah, at best divided, if not fully behind the Democratic Party. I mean, there's very little room for debate about the nature of the war in Ukraine, about its origins, about whether we should be funding it. Very little debate amongst, again, the Democrats and the Democratic base. There's more debate amongst the Republicans, which, again, is that's surprising and a little ironic, but that's
right. And we should also say that there are also some Republican proponents of the war in Ukraine as well.
Oh, although
they're not the majority, but there are some very staunch supporters of the war in Ukraine. Well, let me remind our listeners, we were talking with Dan Kovalik about what's going on in Ukraine, his view of the situation there, and you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Now, you mentioned the Nord Stream pipeline, which was this very long, intricate pipeline that was built between Russia and Europe to deliver cheaper natural gas to the people on the mainland of Europe, right? Europe's mainland. And right. Seymour Hersh recently came out with an article in February, right? Last month. And let me just read this part of it right here. Biden's decision to sabotage the pipelines came after more than 9 months of highly secret back and forth debate inside Washington's national security community about how to best achieve the goal of stopping the relationship, right? Between the economic relationship between Putin's Russia, as they call it, and Europe. How do you view this expose, if you will, of who actually sabotaged and bombed the Nord Stream pipeline?
Well, I think it's powerful. I think it's compelling. I think it's one of the biggest news stories in decades, and yet it's been either ignored by the mainstream press for the most part or pilloried by them. And why is it important? For two reasons. First of all, this is a very important point that I don't think people realize. You have Joe Biden and the Democratic Party who have claimed that they're the ones who want to protect the environment and halt global climate change by limiting emissions, right? Carbon emissions. Meanwhile, if it's true, and I think it is, and I think people should read Seymour Hersh's Pulitzer Prize winning Seymour Hersh's article on this. If Biden did order the sabotage of the pipeline, what he did was engage in the greatest act of environmental terrorism in human history, because that sabotage resulted in the release of 400,000 tons of methane gas into the atmosphere. Good. Methane is 20 times more powerful contributor to global warming than carbon is. Okay, so whatever Joe Biden does in his term of office, and if he gets a second term, whatever he does ever to limit carbon emissions will never come close to making up for what he did, again, assuming he did it, and I do, in sabotaging the Nord Stream pipelines. People should be furious. People should be calling for an investigation, certainly, of who did it. You saw this week that Russia and China put a resolution in the UN Security Council calling for such an independent investigation, and the U.S. and other countries voted that down. The U.S. doesn't want an independent investigation. People who care about the environment should want that investigation. The Greta Thunbergs of the world should be protesting about this. You know, she, several months ago, was protesting because a little coal mine was being restarted in Germany, okay? Which is fine, but those coal mines are being restarted in Germany because Germany's been cut off from natural gas from Russia by this war and by U.S.-led sanctions and by the destruction of those pipelines.
Which is an ecological disaster. So if you really care about this,
yeah, if you care about this issue, you should really care about those pipelines, though incredibly. And again, I have to blame, you know, the Democratic Party and its base for not calling for that and not seeming to care that this happened. Of course, the other thing it did, the second reason people should care, is because if the U.S. was behind the sabotage of that pipeline, it also means the U.S. was behind sabotaging the economies of its allies in Western Europe, particularly Germany's, but also the U.K.'s and others. That is a huge issue. And that Biden would have done this without congressional authorization, and apparently he didn't even inform Congress he was going to do. In engaging in really what is an act of war, not just against Russia, but against its own allies, to me, is an arguably impeachable offense. But again, very few people seem to care. But this is the most important story in decades, and people are ignoring it. And that it's just not justifiable.
Well, let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifico Radio, and that's the voice of our guest today, Daniel Kovalik. We're discussing Ukraine and his views of it. We started by talking about his book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, which was published in 2017. But Dan, I mean, I have so much more to talk to you about. First of all, you know, this idea of spheres of influence, because I remember growing up during the Cold War. Right, I'm one of those duck and cover babies, right? Or kids who had to hide under his desk with his arm behind his neck and his arm in front of his face and was told that that was going to save me from a nuclear blast. Of course, none of us really believed it. And the Cuban Missile Crisis, of course. And I remember in part of the lexicon of the U.S. during the Cold War that I grew up with was this concept of spheres of influence, that Cuba was within the U.S. sphere of influence. Therefore, Russia had no right in encroachment. Of course, this goes back to the theory and the ideas of the Monroe Doctrine and how Latin America, you know, is the U.S. backyard and sphere of influence, and that no other country could impinge upon that exceptional claim that the United States often uses to justify its foreign policy. Now, suddenly, we have what is being called an encroachment on Russia's sphere of influence, which is being portrayed not as that, but as a war of liberation. And just this week, Russia announced that they are going to be putting short-range nuclear missiles in Belarus, and that today in the headlines, it has gotten to the point where they're talking about placing strategic nuclear weapons in Belarus and those surrounding areas around Ukraine. to the point where now a top UN official today is urgently calling, the headline is, for de-escalating nuclear tensions over Belarus. My question is, since, am I recalling incorrectly that the U.S. really had a huge investment in this concept of spheres of influence? And don't U.S. policymakers realize that they are flipping the meaning and now calling this encroachment and wanting to have an ally closer to, as part of NATO, which is right on the mainland with Russia, where they could theoretically also place strategic nuclear weapons? Don't U.S. policymakers consider this escalation getting out of hand, that there are so many parts to this and so much invested in the propaganda and in winning this war against the evil Russia, this could easily go sideways?
Yes. Well, and honest people have called what's happening right now in the Ukraine conflict, and even before, with NATO's encroachment up to Russia's borders, right? NATO has troops and nuclear missiles up to Russia's borders. That needs to be pointed out.
And the U.S. would never accept the same thing. If Russia did something similar in Mexico, and I've heard that argument, I made that argument or said that argument early on, the United States would never accept Russia or any other nation doing the same thing in Mexico, for example.
Absolutely not. And again, how do we know this? Because when the Soviets tried it once in Cuba in 1962, the U.S. was ready to go to war over that. And in 13 days, thankfully, Kennedy and Khrushchev negotiated us out of that possible nuclear conflict. But the world was on edge, knowing a nuclear conflict might come, because the U.S. would never put up with that. In the end, it was Kennedy negotiated by saying, he, in return for the Soviet Union removing the missiles from Cuba, the U.S. would not attack Cuba again, and it would remove its own missiles.
It's often touted as one of the greatest moments of diplomacy in the history of the world at that moment. Right?
And we have no such diplomacy now on our end, okay? First of all, which needs to be said. Biden, far from trying to negotiate a solution to this problem in Ukraine, he could have easily prevented the Russian intervention in Ukraine last year by simply saying that Ukraine would not be part of NATO and that Ukraine would stop attacking the Donbass. Far from doing that, the U.S. ignored Russia's legitimate security concerns and legitimate looking at it from their point of view, again, if they were us. And you point out Mexico, and really what happened, just to put a finer point on it, what the U.S. would never tolerate is the following in Mexico, but this is exactly what they want Russia to tolerate in Ukraine, okay? It would be as if Russia in 2014 installed a right-wing government or whatever, a government, a pro-Russian government in Mexico City that had animus towards its English-speaking population. Let's assume there is a big one somewhere in the north of Mexico. And that Russia supported the new government in Mexico to attack those English-speaking people, mostly from the United States, in Mexico, and that 14,000 people died as a result, and hundreds of thousands of immigrants from Mexico flooded into the U.S. fleeing that conflict. And then Russia was threatening, or certainly wouldn't guarantee, that Mexico would not become part of a new Warsaw Pact.
Well, and built a multinational alliance that pumped in billions of dollars of weaponry to that government.
Right. The U.S., what I am saying is so absurd, because the U.S. wouldn't have allowed that to go on for 8 years. They wouldn't have allowed it to go on for 8 days, okay? And that we can't see things from the Russians' perspective on this is incredible. You know, and the problem also, you talk about spheres of influence. Here's the other problem. Countries like Russia and China, for example, who we vilify so much, they see their spheres of influence as on their borders of their own country. The U.S. sees its sphere of influence as everywhere, right? The U.S. sees the South China Sea as its influence. It sees the Persian Gulf as its sphere of influence. It sees Ukraine as its sphere of influence. The U.S. thinks it has the right to total domination of the entire earth. And that's how we got into this problem to begin with, right? That is unacceptable, and it's untenable, and it's not sustainable. This is what is going to lead us into another world war. And again, that not enough Americans see that and reject it is incredible, because it doesn't make any sense. You can't say, oh, we're worried about China's maneuvers in the South China Sea. It's called the South China Sea. It's not the U.S. Sea. Oh, we're worried about Iran and the Persian Gulf. It's called the Persian Gulf. Maybe the Persians have a right. They have some mind to it.
No. I mean, the view is it's our world and you're just living in it.
Yeah. And we say, you know, but what is happening, the truth is, and why most of the world, in truth, is siding with Russia in this, and that's a fact. Outside of Western Europe, outside of the North America, not including Mexico.
Important point.
Mm-hmm. Outside of Australia, New Zealand, and Japan, the rest of the world is siding with Russia. And why? Because they're tired of the U.S. claiming that it owns the world. They're tired of the U.S. and NATO invading countries like Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya and Somalia and Serbia at will, going halfway around the world to engage in wars of choice. And the world has said, we're done. And they see Russia, and this is the truth, and people have to understand this, they see Russia as finally standing up, not only for itself, but the rest of the world, in saying that enough is enough. And again, that people can't see that and can't empathize with that in a certain way means we're doomed, right? Because we would not be able to negotiate our way out of a situation that we don't understand.
And it's quickly escalating.
That is escalating to possible nuclear conflict. Every day we're moving closer and closer to that. And, you know, I've heard people like Colonel Douglas McGregor, who's also very good on this issue, say things like, you know, up till now, every U.S. president has seen their main job as preventing a nuclear war, right? That would be the worst thing that could happen to us and for all of humanity. And really took steps to try to prevent that. Even Reagan, who was a warmonger in his own right in many ways, did a lot to ratchet down, really to end the Cold War and to ratchet down the nuclear standoff with us and the Soviet Union. Instead, yeah, Biden, who is doing everything to stir that up. And again, people who are in the Democratic Party have to say, we don't want this. This is not right. You're our president, and you shouldn't be doing that. You need to prevent a nuclear war, which could wipe out all of human life, right? Again, instead, the liberals seem to be going along with it. And you see crazy articles in, like, the New York Times with people arguing for at least a limited nuclear war, if there is such a thing.
Yeah, it's too bad. It's too bad there's 1.5 million children in the United States who are homeless, living out of cars and having no place to bathe and are under malnourished. Too bad they don't have a flag that people can put on their social media accounts.
Yeah, well, of course you've seen the memes where, you know, you'll see a homeless guy draped in a Ukrainian flag, hoping that'll get him some help, right? Yeah, it's incredible. And again, the people don't see it. It's just it's anger provoking. The people who I had confidence in, that I, you know, used to go to peace marches with, don't see this. It just shows the extent of the propaganda.
We're gonna garner the the usual remarks about, you know, you know you're a puppet, you're a stooge of Putin, right? You know that, right?
Yeah, of course. That is what people claim.
You understand it would all be critical, and to question the propaganda and the policy, you know, is in itself a de facto admission of being funded by Russia somehow.
Right, and people are being punished for that. By the way, your introduction to me is still good through April, but after that, it won't be. I just lost my teaching job at Pitt.
Oh.
And I think largely over my public position on what's happening in Ukraine, and this is what's happening. People are being punished and silenced.
There goes academic freedom.
Yeah, there is none. The academy doesn't want to hear the other side, particularly on this issue.
Well, and what I don't understand is, you know, if we call ourselves a democracy, that explicitly means an informed constituency. And that information comes through discourse of divergent views. That's at the heart of what I would believe is democratic discourse. So why shouldn't we have this discussion? Why shouldn't we present this alternative view when so much of the overwhelming view that we're receiving in the mainstream media, right? And I can call them mainstream because it's still absolutely true. Look it up, folks, that six corporations own 90% of the media in the United States. That's a fact. Why shouldn't we have alternative discourses like this, Dan? They're important, aren't they, too, if we're going to call ourselves, you know, quote unquote, a democratic nation?
Yeah, well, of course I agree with you. You know, but again, the truth of the matter is that most people who say they want freedom and democracy don't necessarily really want that. You know what comes to mind? I think about this scene all the time. The scene from Easy Rider. I don't know if you remember.
Oh, yeah.
Jack Nicholson's talking to Dennis Hopper, and they're talking about freedom, and Jack Nicholson says, he says, you know, and people who say they want freedom, you know, when they meet someone who's truly free, are the first ones who want to shut him down, right? In the next scene, he's beaten to death with baseball bats in his sleeping bag, right? I think that says it all. I mean, people can talk about, oh, democracy, freedom. First of all, what do those things mean? And second of all, is that what you want, or you just want people to, you know, fit into your own worldview? And I think mostly it's the latter most of the time.
Well, I want to thank you, Dan. Great conversation. I didn't really get enough into your experience, you know, in Donbass and Donetsk and the other places that you visited. It was just last November you were there.
Yeah, and I'm going back in 3 weeks. Yeah.
Well, exactly. I can't wait to debrief you and hear what you got to say then. Before I let you go, I just want to remind our listeners that John J. Mearsheimer, Mearsheimer, is an international relations theorist. He is the R. Wendell Harrison Distinguished Service Professor in the Political Science Department at the University of Chicago. Find his articles. They are the counterpoint to the mainstream media, as well as Dan's excellent book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia, which I think sets the context perfectly, as I said earlier in our interview. Playing with Fire in Ukraine, The Underappreciated Risks of Catastrophic Escalation by Mearsheimer, and another article he wrote, Why the West is Principally Responsible for the Ukrainian Crisis. And I'm sure you agree, Dan, that those are our listeners should read those, as well as your excellent book, The Plot to Scapegoat Russia.
Kevin, thank you. This was a pleasure.
My pleasure. Again, that was Dan Kovalik. He's an American lawyer and human rights advocate who currently teaches internet. Oh,
I do, currently.
who is going to lose his job soon teaching international human rights at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Most importantly, he's the author of several books, including his most recent, The Plot to Overthrow Venezuela, How the U.S. is Orchestrating a Coup for Oil. Dan, thanks again.
Hey, thank you, Kevin.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And today I want to turn our attention to a very special place, a place that's very close to my heart, and I'm sure many people's hearts in the community and across the country, really. And that's the battle over People's Park that is still being waged in Berkeley after all of these years. I was one of the producers of a film called Berkeley in the 60s, if you haven't seen it, produced by Mark Kitchell and directed by Mark Kitchell. And there's a real great section of that film which gives you great background to the history of People's Park, including the sacrifice of lives in order to keep this as a sanctuary and memory, largely of the counterculture movement and of the anti-war movement and the depth of the anti-war movement that occurred in Berkeley. I don't know, folks maybe don't know this, but you know, the National Guard, Reagan sent in the National Guard, and they occupied Oakland and Berkeley for a period of time because of the resistance that people in places like People's Park and the streets of Berkeley and the streets of Oakland offered against that horrendous war, the Vietnam War, that was waged in the name of the American people. My two guests today are contemporaries who are still fighting that good fight for People's Park. Joining us today is Joe Leisner. He was amazingly an organizer for the Mississippi Freedom Summer with Bob Moses. He organized for 23 years with Food Not Bombs. Today, he's part of the Omni Collective in Oakland, and he's on the People's Park Historic District Advocacy Group. And joining us also is Harvey Smith, who's a longtime resident of Berkeley. He has lived there since 1966. He's also a member of the People's Park Historic District Advocacy Group. Joe and Harvey, welcome to Flashpoints today.
Nice to be here, Kevin.
Well, listen, let's start with a little bit of where the historical significance, what is, in your view, and let's start with Harvey, what is, in your view, the historical significance of People's Park contemporaneously today? Why should people value People's Park as a historic site?
Well, it's for some of the things that you were just saying, Kevin, but, you know, the park has a long history. And our group worked to get the park on the National Register of Historic Places. So this issue really goes beyond Berkeley. It goes beyond California. It's a national historic site. And unlike other historic sites from the same period, you can look at Woodstock or you can look at Kent State that are also on the National Register. Mm-hmm. However, those sites are commemorated for events that happened over 50 years ago. So People's Park is a very live, happening, continuous place that has existed and is given to the people of Berkeley and the nation as a whole. It's a cultural site, it's a historic site, and it's a very, also very essential, important open space in the most densely populated part of Berkeley, and a part of Berkeley that is planned to become even more populated.
Okay, Joe Leisner, let's bring you in this conversation now. Let's talk about where that is now and what the issue is. UC Berkeley wants to build housing there, much needed student housing. And local residents claim that People's Park has become a cesspool, for want of a better word, a sanctuary for unruly homeless people who are on drugs. So how is the person, someone who doesn't know much about People's Park, what's your view of that? What's at stake in People's Park today?
Good question. It's very important that it is answered honestly. And the honest answer is, if you look at the park today, there are serious problems. The thing is, the problems could have been addressed long ago and more seriously by UC if they simply maintained the park the way they maintain their other properties and the campus.
They don't maintain it? They don't maintain it?
No. They have always worked against the people that were trying to improve the park, that were trying to use the park to serve the people that needed food, that didn't have clothing. We do not advocate the park as a place of habitation. The problems with that have just shown themselves recently to be more than we can deal with. Our vision for the park is a place that continues, you know, to advocate for people that need a sort of sanctuary from the corporate police state that we currently seem to live in. But the university, I think it's hard not to see that leaving the park to deteriorate to the point that it has today has served them well. It's actually created this image of the park as a place that needs to be, well, their intent is to destroy it. They claim that they're going to revitalize the park, but that's sheer hypocrisy. They've never been really interested in taking care of the park. As I've been working for Food Not Bombs over the years, simple things like asking the university's permission to have waste management come on the property to pick up, you know, our leftovers at the end of the meal, they wouldn't agree to that. They've cut down free boxes where we attempted to give out clothing. So we do have a vision for the park, and we want to, you know, work with the university to find the housing site somewhere else where it won't destroy a site that's on the National Register, and we can have them both if the university would agree to some sort of cooperative venture.
And let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and my guests are, you just heard the voice of Joe Leisner. He's with the People's Park Historic District Advocacy Group, along with Harvey Smith, who is also part of that group and a longtime resident who's been in Berkeley since 1966. Harvey, where's the legal battle at? Now, there's been a legal battle around People's Park. Where is that at today?
Well, at this very point, we just won in the Court of Appeals. So a three-judge panel decided there were five issues before the court. They decided in our favor on two of them. And one of them was that the university did not look at alternative sites. And that's required under the law. And they saw that very clearly. The other one was noise. And what UC has done and is really put out a lot of disinformation about this case, and it has, and I think in the way Joe was describing about the park in general, but so we won on those two issues. What they've done is that they've blown the issue of noise all out of proportion, saying that this is gloom and doom, that the CEQA law has to be changed because of this, and almost totally ignoring in their public statements the fact that the court also found they did not explore alternatives, which is our essential issue. The other thing that they did in terms of disinformation was that they described the opposition to the park. So our group and the other the co-plaintiff as NIMBY neighbors, meaning not in our backyard. And that is a total lie, because our group is not from a specific neighborhood. It's made up of people from all over Berkeley, all over California, all over the country, and we have a few supporters from outside the country. So there's well over 250 people that have either supported us, signed on and endorsed Saving the Park, or have also contributed funds to pursue the lawsuit. So at this point, the university is going to appeal to the Supreme Court. And they keep losing in court, but they keep going back to the court. So we'll see. What they have tried to do was to do, and they did this somewhat successfully on another case, was do an end run. In the other case, it was won in the Supreme Court, and they went to the legislature and asked the legislature to change CEQA. So the California Environmental Quality Act. And we assume that they'll probably do this too, because unfortunately, some of the media and some of the legislators and even the governor have picked up on their disinformation, called our group a NIMBY neighbor, you know, focused on the noise issue rather than alternatives.
Not in my backyard, so, right?
You're right, not in my backyard. So so there's big money opposition to CEQA, because there are people, real estate developers, the utilities, the oil industry, that doesn't want any guardrails.
They don't want regulation. They don't want the precedent.
Excuse me?
They don't want the precedent to be established.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, this would be a kind of precedent, but what actual fact-based investigation of CEQA shows, and this was done by the Rose Foundation, who did a study to show that CEQA really actually has little impact on halting development, but it has a lot of impact in protecting the environment. So that's the core issue, but you know, industry, big industries, big corporations don't want to have any regulation. Look at, right. I think, a parallel example, although it's more graphic, is the railroad industry. You know, despite constant train wrecks, they want to be less regulated, not more regulated. And I think that that's similar here in California around issues of the California Environmental Quality Act.
And finally,
yeah, if I could just
Sure, go ahead, Joe.
If you look at things, the pro-development faction is always waiting for an opportunity to jump in with a long-standing attempt to neutralize and sort of take a lot of the power out of CEQA. CEQA is recognized by many groups. A group called CEQA Works is 200 different environmental groups that attest to all the good CEQA has done. And it's not used very often. Only 2% of the cases that are ever required to have EIRs actually go under litigation. So it's really a red herring. And they're using words like we're holding housing hostage and we're weaponizing CEQA. And it's really disgusting to hear the governor use words like that. It's very, very much using kind of hate language.
Governor Newsom is describing the California Environmental Quality Act that way?
Yes. He's describing us as using it that way. It's kind of like being branded as a terrorist without actually saying it. It's dog whistle language.
Well, I wonder, why haven't you folks created a nonprofit conservancy and raised either private money to purchase the land from the university, come up with an agreement to purchase it from them, which I'm sure they don't want, and or work with the city of Berkeley? You know, let's get the next progressive government in there, city government in there, and let's talk about public domain, or let's talk about the city taking over that parcel of land in the name of maintaining its historic integrity.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what Harvey and I have been working on. I just got done yesterday talking to somebody from the Trust for Public Land. Well, the first thing is that the university has to be forced, I imagine, either through legal or the court of public opinion, to agree to transfer some aspect of their ownership. That could be done, as you say, in two ways, either through a conservancy called a conservancy easement, or actually, you know, selling the land, the actual deed. And of course, they keep saying that they have unwavering dedication to building the housing on the park. So that avenue hasn't been open to us, but we do realize that that's the way to go. The other hard part is the city is not at all able to see the importance of the park, the fact that they're just creating all kinds of dangerous situations, wasting now a half a year, and it probably is going to go much longer with the appeal to the Supreme Court, wasting time. No student housing is getting done, and millions of dollars have been wasted. So that's what we want to do, Kevin.
And let's be honest, folks who know Berkeley politics know that, you know, today's city government is a far cry from when Gus Newport was mayor, for example, right? There's been this slow slide to the right, getting closer to, as you said, developers' interests in the city of Berkeley. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. And we have a very important document from Gus and Shirley, two of the former mayors, that are saying, let's get this housing project built on an alternative site that pays respect to the importance of people's park and stop wasting time. But the city hasn't even recognized the fact that we're on the National Register. After 5 years of writing a very tedious document and having it, you know, approved unanimously by the Office of Historic Preservation, the city won't even recognize it. And at the same time, they dare to say that the university will write some sort of memorial when they should they win and build on the park. Well, they don't have the right to do that. They wouldn't even. They were the only people that wrote a letter of objection to us being nominated for the National Register, the University of California, that is. And the chairman of the commission, when they voted unanimously, was just incensed by the fact that they would write the only letter of opposition. How can you oppose the national historic importance of People's Park? But well, they so, did.
Some folks might say that that's indicative of the sort of corporate education direction that the UC system has been going in anyway. They're finding themselves more closer to running their own university, their own house, as a corporate entity for profit rather than as an educational institution that's going to serve the diversity and the majority of the people in our state of California. Listen, guys, I'm going to go. Again, this is Flashpoint San Pacifico Radio, and you're listening to my guests today, Joe Leisner and Harvey Smith. Both of them represent the People's Park Historic District Advocacy Group. But you guys,
you are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Lady Sings the Blues, a tribute to Billie Holiday 2023. On Saturday, April 8th, from 8 p.m. to 10:45 p.m. at the Alberta Rose Theater in Portland. The 16th annual Billie Holiday tribute brings together musicians of many genres to pay tribute to influential jazz singer and songwriter Billie Holiday. Performances feature Marsha Hocker, LaRonda Steele, Arietta Ward, and more. Again, that's the 16th annual Billie Holiday Tribute Night, Lady Sings the Blues, on Saturday, April 8th, from 8 p.m. to 10:45 p.m. at the Alberta Rose Theater, 3000 North.